supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. When I was in elementary school back in the 50s, I got poor grades, very poor grades that got worse in middle school and high school. The choices back then was I was either lazy or stupid. I knew I wasn't lazy, so I honestly thought I was stupid. I have since learned as a psychologist that schools simply didn't teach the way I learned. Now, some 50 years later, it's worse. Research shows today that boys are not being served well by American schools, in which the rates in which they are expelled is getting sky high. They're getting involved in drugs and violent behavior and diagnosed with a learning disability at much higher rates than girls. But what's causing us boys to fall behind? Is it culture? The nature of education? Is it the structure of the family? Some argue that our attention to the plight of girls and their low self-esteem has inadvertently made life more difficult for boys. So what needs to be done to make life more balanced for our boys? Later on in the show, we'll hear from Dr. Mark Kisakela. He's a psychologist and professor of counseling at the College of New Jersey. He's author of Counseling Troubled Boys and When Boys Become Parents. But now we're going to speak with Peg Tyer. She's the author of Trouble with Boys, and she's a longtime investigative reporter and staff writer for Newsweek, and she also serves as a correspondent for CNN. Peg, welcome to the show.
Oh, nice to be here.
Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you are a parent of a boy or a boy or an ex-boy, past boy, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Peg, you were originally writing about girls. Why the shift?
You know, I as a former girl myself, I was really much more attuned to the plight of girls and very well aware of the crisis of self-esteem they seem to suffer from in the middle school years. I had grown up on the literature of reviving Ophelia and how schools shortchange girls. And so I was really looking much more for the problems girls face. And it wasn't until I was in schools for a couple of years. I was an education writer for Newsweek for 7 years. I left there last year, but I was in schools for about 2 years before I started noticing, well, you know, the kids who are in the back, the ones who are completely disengaged, are disproportionately boys. The parents who I meet who are tearing out their hair about their kids in school are parents of boys. I know that in college there are 2.5 million more girls than boys. So I started to wonder, was my attention misplaced? Was there something going on with boys? And so I started to do a great deal of research. And what I found was, yes, indeed, there's something quite profound going on with boys, a pervasive underachievement in school that affects boys from every group and every demographic.
I am curious. You might not know the answer. The attention to girls begins, I believe, and we talked about it in last week's show when we talked about girls, the classic American Association University women study that focused on their self-esteem, how it went down. And so the focus was on girls' self-esteem, and it also showed that boys' self-esteem didn't necessarily go down. So,
well, let's talk about those numbers for a minute. Yes, girls surely do report more stress and depression. They surely do talk more. They disclose more about their feelings of insecurity and low self-esteem. But let's look at the suicide rates. School-aged children, suicide rates. Boys kill themselves at 5 times the rates of girls. So, yes, girls do report more stress and depression, but they were really good socio-behavioral markers that indicate that boys are really in trouble.
Right, right. They are in trouble, and it may or may not be related to self-esteem. I want to hear voices of some real young men. I want to listen to a clip of our producer, Gita Simon. She spoke with four Temple University students about their school experiences as adolescents. Let's listen.
What was school like?
I was always more focused on going home and playing sports. That was more my focus when I was coming out of elementary school.
What would it have taken for school to be interesting to you?
Maybe more physical interaction rather than just sitting there looking at the board. Maybe changing the scenery of the classroom, maybe going outside and into a field or a yard, as corny as that may sound, just to change it a little bit. Maybe the teacher could have more hands-on type of things rather than lecture and just look at a board and write notes and look in your book.
How about you?
It's a time in life when learning becomes more of a chore and less of something that you actually enjoy doing, unless you have someone extremely engaging. I think humor is a big part at any level. If a teacher's funny and can connect with kids on a comedic level, they can make any material, whether it's social studies or science, seem entertaining at least.
Let's start at the beginning with you.
Well, I grew up in Texas, first of all, and I was the only person of of a different ethnic group or a different background. When I moved there, I thought that, I was gonna make all these friends, everybody was gonna love me. That wasn't the case at all.
What was the case?
It was a lot of racial pressure. It was a lot of academic pressure from my mom as well. It's just, I felt like I had nowhere to turn. I felt I was in a world all by myself, and it was very painful. They would always take my stuff, and they take my books and run away, and they'll say things like, "What is the N-word doing reading a book?" and things of that sort, and say horrible things about my hair and skin color. So yeah, that was very painful. But then I just kind of accepted that, thinking, that's just the way it is growing up in this area. I tried to seek refuge with the teachers and faculty, and then what they would do is they just overlook it. They'd say, "Oh, there's nothing going on here. Don't worry about it." That's why I kind of felt as though I was in a world all by myself.
That was our producer, Gita Simon, speaking with some Temple University students about their school experience. So, Peg, we're hearing a lot of issues here with these guys. And
let me just point out, those are the ones who made it to Temple University, a fine school. Those are not the ones who end up dropping out. And as we know, boys are much more likely to drop out than girls, especially boys of color, much more likely to drop out than girls. Those are the ones who actually succeeded. So think of what the ones who are hanging out in the corner could tell us.
Well, speaking of dropping out, when we spoke with you earlier, you said that in preschool, boys are 5 times more likely to be expelled and retained after school.
Isn't that an interesting statistic
now, what,
in preschool?
I was just going to say, the ratio doesn't strike me as much as the fact is, what are they doing throwing kids out of preschool?
Well, that research came out of Yale, and it really looked at state-run preschools. And I actually didn't even realize that kids got expelled from preschool. But when I started to do my research, surely boys and their parents who have had this experience are not that hard to find. So I asked myself, what is going on at preschool that could be creating this difficulty for little boys? And so, of course, I look back in history. So looking back, was there ever a golden age of preschool for boys? Well, it turns out, of course, that preschool is a fairly new phenomenon in the numbers that our kids are going now. Preschool is very common now, not so common 25 years ago. So I had to shorten my timeline. What has changed about preschool in the last 15, 12, 10 years? Well, I will tell you one thing. The major trend that's affected preschool is that preschools have become much, much more academic. And in my book, I go into this a great deal, why this has happened. It's happened for very good reasons. Parents think that this is the way young children learn, and they need to get up to speed for kindergarten, which, as you know, now has a curriculum. But it turns out that although we're doing this for very good reasons, academic preschool turns out to be bad for boys. It actually hurts their school achievement, not to mention the fact that many, many more get expelled than used to.
Why does it hurt their achievement?
Well, the data is silent on why that would happen. The data came out of the University of Northern Florida, and it was a social scientist who followed three groups of kids. She followed their academic achievement following their experience in preschool, three different kinds of preschool, one highly academic, one social, and social academic mixed, and one entirely social. And what she found is that the highly kids in highly academic preschools did better initially, and then their achievement didn't flatline, but it didn't grow as dramatically as the groups in the other two kinds of preschools. And then they all kind of leveled out. The mixed social and academic did better. But for boys who went to highly academic preschools, their school achievement dropped below any of the three groups.
Well, I'll give you a theory about which I am very confident about. You take a young boy or any young child with an active body, and you ask that body to stay still for 6 hours, and it's going to affect brain development. I'm very confident.
Now, I looked at this because so many parents said you need to look at the role of physical activity in schools. And surely we see the number of kids diagnosed with ADHD and learning disabilities and behavior disorders rising as we see the minutes that are given over to the school day to physical activity, recess, PE, free play, dropping. So you have two different trend lines: physical movement dropping, diagnosable problems rising, right? So I tried to look at, well, why would this be affecting boys more than girls? I'm a girl who's a former girl who's actually kind of antsy myself, so I require a lot of running around. But I went to a fascinating fellow in Canada who has made his life's work studying gender and movement and human development. And I said, well, why would the lack of recess affect boys more than girls? And he showed me his data, which he had been compiling for 20 years. And his data shows that, indeed, pretty much what you've observed, that boys do move around a little more than girls, but there's a big overlap. But the kids who are the outliers, the ones who are most sedentary, tend to be predominantly girls, and the ones who tend to be most active, the real ants-in-the-pants kids, are overwhelmingly boys. So I would argue, and I do argue in my chapter in the book, The Trouble with Boys, that if you reduce opportunities for physical movement in school, you hurt all kids. We know that this is not a good way for children to learn, but you crush a certain segment of kids, and those kids are disproportionately boys.
Hmm. Well, yeah, we know that physical activity is good for boys, good for kids, it's good for brain, it's good for learning.
It's good for me.
right, yeah. So, you know, the fact that you say it's good for you makes me challenge your diagnosis of being a former girl. You sound like a current girl, too.
I'm a distance runner in the 40 and above category.
Well, you know, we know that about activity, but we also know now about these young kids, and you know, we'll talk with Mark in a later segment in the show. We know about young kids, the best way for their brains to learn is to do nothing. You know, we don't have to shove stuff into kids' brains for them to learn. You know, they create. They go out and they learn stuff. You see it with infants and toddlers. You know, it's harmful to a brain to try to teach it when it's too young.
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't really seen that research. I mean, I do see that for many kids, exposing them early and often to things like reading is very, very important, and counting their fingers and toes in the bathtub and taking them to the grocery store and pointing out different foods and packagings and letters. I mean, all those experiences are very important. And, you know, middle-class kids get those experiences as a routine part of their day. Kids who come from less enriched environments tend not to. And we know that poor kids come to school speaking fewer words, having heard fewer words, than middle-class kids. So there's reasons that we want our schools to expose our children widely to some academics, but the problem really is when we begin to think that learning for four-year-olds looks like a scaled-down version of fourth grade, okay? Sitting with a worksheet and a pencil is not a good form of learning in a preschool. Yet parents thinking that they need to bring this early exposure to learning to their children are demanding that our preschools do this.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that's a good form of learning for any grade.
Right, you know? Right. But I think fourth graders, you know, there is a way that many of them can tolerate it, where four-year-olds, it's just not developmentally appropriate.
We're talking with Peg Tyer, author of The Trouble with Boys. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Christina on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Christina.
I'm a mother of two boys, 7 and 11, and the 11-year-old is classified with, he was originally PDD-NOS, and they've just reevaluated him, and they want him to be Asperger's. And my husband and I have been always very ambivalent about this whole thing. And I was just wondering, you know, are girls classified as... I understand they're not classified as often as boys.
Yes. So I'm not quite clear on your question, Christina.
Well, it's just that, you know, you're talking about, you know, little boys. I mean, my younger child is actually... He seems to have a problem with, like, physical activity. He's always moving, but they haven't said anything about him.
Hmm.
But
well,
the older one, hardly, he doesn't like to move a lot.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I was going to bring Mark Kiselica on after our break. I'm going to bring him on now. Mark is a psychologist and professor of counseling at the College of New Jersey. He's written Counseling Troubled Boys. So, Mark, what's your take on Christina's?
Well, I understand Christine's concern. And, Christine, I think the question you're asking is are these type of diagnosis and classifications more common in boys? And as Dr. Tyer's research has demonstrated, the answer is yes. If you look at pervasive developmental disorders, which is the grouping of difficulties in which your son has been classified, boys are much more likely to suffer from these type of difficulties. And we don't exactly know why, but we do know that boys are greatly overrepresented among this. And it's understandable that you would be a little confused, because it sounds like you're not getting a very clear message diagnostically about what is going on with him. So I encourage you to seek another opinion, so that you can try to get a handle on exactly what his particular problem is, and so that your school can then go ahead and come up with a plan that's tailored toward his particular needs.
And can she, and I'm going to ask this question to both of you, Mark and Peg, will the school necessarily meet that child's needs? Peg, let me turn to you.
Well, I think that if he is on the spectrum for autism, that presents a lot of questions for the family. And certainly schools are getting more adept at inclusion classes and handling children who have different needs and different learning needs. But without a doubt, that will be a challenge.
Mark?
Well, I agree with what Peg said. The encouraging news is that the federal government now requires schools to come up with individualized educational plans for children who have special needs. And so, Christine, what I encourage you to do is to be an advocate for your child. It's understandable that you would be confused. Continue to ask questions. See if you can get a second opinion, and then work with the school to come up with a plan that will address your son's particular needs.
Christina, thanks so much for your call, and we do wish you the best. We're going to take a short break now. Peg, can you stay with us for...
I'd be happy to.
So we're talking about boys, what's happening to them in school, and what can be done to help both schools and as we raise them and talk with them and counsel them. My guests are Peg Tyer. She's the author of The Trouble with Boys. She's a longtime investigative reporter and staff writer for Newsweek, and she also serves as a CNN correspondent. Dr. Mark Kiselica, and I got your name right this time, Mark? Yay, Dan. He's a psychologist and professor of counseling at the College of New Jersey. He's author of Counseling Troubled Boys and When Boys Become Parents, Adolescent fatherhood in America. Our number is 888-477-9499. If our lines are busy, please be patient. We will try to get to you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY and announces two new degree programs, BS in Physics and PhD in Cell and Molecular Biology. The Physics undergrad program has biophysics and materials science tracks for careers in the emerging science of the 21st century. The PhD in Cell and Molecular Biology enables students to work with genes and proteins to help solve real-world problems. More about these programs at usp.edu.
Portland band Blitz and Trapper looks to rock's roots for inspiration.
But while they reference the past, lead singer Eric Early knows their songs set them apart.
I think the important thing is to write good songs. And if the songs are honest and mirror your personality and the uniqueness of the individual writing it, then people will enjoy it.
I'm Jim DeRogatis. Join me and Greg Kot this week on Sound Opinions as we welcome Blitz and Trapper.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about boys, what's happening with them, what needs to be done, and what we can do. My guests are Dr. Mark Kiselica. He's a psychologist, professor of counseling at College of New Jersey. He's written Counseling Troubled Boys. Peg Tyer is the author of The Trouble with Boys and a longtime investigative reporter and staff writer for Newsweek. She also serves as a CNN correspondent. Peg, I want to come back to you. One of the chapters in your book says that we want to fix the school and not the boy. Easier said than done.
I agree with that. But I think that there's a lot in schools that has changed, and it has changed for some very good reasons, but is inadvertently disadvantaging our sons. And I think it's a lot easier to put a diagnosis on a child, on a boy, for being ADHD or having a behavioral problem, rather than looking at the kind of instruction that's going on in the classroom, the kind of scheduling that's going on, whether there's enough downtime, opportunity for free play, physical movement, that kind of thing. So I think it's a lot easier to pin the problem on the child, and I think that a lot of parents could probably relate to this, that that schools often want to make your son the problem, when if you look at their achievement rates in the nation, the schools, there's something bigger going on than just your son.
Well, you're right. Here's the problem, though. They diagnose these kids. They medicate them. They psychotherapize them, and then they're able to be more conforming with the school's expectations. So that's the problem. It's working. You know, the medication, the psychotherapy is working. Mark, I want you to weigh in on this, because a lot of these boys are being sent to you, I imagine.
Well, I could not agree with Peg more regarding her concerns as it relates to the expectations we have of boys at a very young age in school. Peg is not only right about the types of activities we're expecting children to do at a very young age, but when you look at research about brain development in boys, what we now know is that the portion of the brain that's responsible largely for the development and acquisition of reading develops on average a year later in boys than it does in girls. And our entire educational system is designed to start kids in kindergarten at around age 5. And if you look at the average, then most boys are being put into a situation where they're probably not developmentally ready. So it's not a question of them having some sort of mental illness or a lack of willpower. It's that we're asking boys systemically to do things that they tend not to be ready to do. And then they get in trouble in school.
Okay. I hear you both. But the question is, now what? I mean, what can we do to change schools?
Well, my idea in writing this book was to, I'm not an educator, and I don't run schools, but I am very, very good with information. And my hope in writing this book was to give parents a document with the very best information in it about what we know about boys and about what we know about changes in schools. So if you are having this trouble, you can use this as a jumping off point. So if you're getting called into school and your son's in the lowest reading group, this is cause for concern. You need to start asking some questions. But what happens so often in schools is that the teacher says, your son's not working for my classroom, and the parent says, your classroom's not working for my son, and then the discussion kind of goes all to heck right from there, right? So my hope is that with the information in the book, parents and teachers can form a more constructive coalition and say, okay, there's things in this book, there's things in this country where smart educators are doing things that are working for boys, demonstrably. Maybe we could try this. Like, teachers don't want to not teach boys.
Of course.
They want to do well with all our children, but a lot of them just don't have the tools.
You said things, there's programs in this country that are working. Tell us about them.
Well, let me just tell you one thing that I discovered. It turns out that, there's a big push for children to read early and read often. And it turns out that there's different ways of teaching reading. There's the whole language method, which is recognizing words, and there's phonics. Now, phonics has fallen out of favor in the last 20 years in many areas. It's seen as not as progressive. It's more authoritarian or top-down. It doesn't involve so much collaboration with the teacher. But there's people who have studied this, really good studies that have been replicated all over the nation that suggest that phonics is a better way to teach boys how to read. Now, not every boy. This is not the answer for every child. I mean, we're a sophisticated group of people. We understand that when we talk about boys, we talk about half the world, right? But if you knew that there were good studies to suggest that phonics was better for many boys, if you knew that there's a massive reading gap between boys and girls, if you understood that reading on grade level at eighth grade is how school administrators predict levels of high school dropouts, right? If you understood what high school dropouts are costing us in terms of our nation, in terms of criminal justice costs, then you might want your second grade or your first grade teacher to know that research about boys and reading, because it has massive implications for how children do in school, how our boys do in school, how our boys do in society.
Mark, you reacted when Peg was talking about teaching boys phonics.
Well, once again, she is right on target.
I love this guy.
Yeah.
So email me afterwards.
Well,
I love people who agree with me.
Yes. Just one example. There was a major study done in California, and the data coming out of that study showed that an entire generation of children, not just boys but girls too, but especially boys, were struggling with reading because there was too much emphasis on the whole language approach. So Peg's raising awareness about phonics and its contributions to children's learning in general, and boys in particular, is very helpful. And the other piece of advice I would give to parents, getting back to your question, Dan, what can we do to help then? We have to encourage parents to say, don't push your son ahead simply because the system says that you should. You have a good sense for what your son's abilities are and his readiness. And if your gut says he's not ready to go to kindergarten or to go to first grade, then give him an extra year.
There's a downside of that.
Yes.
I've got two kids who I know and love dearly, both of whom were held back, and both of whom talk about that years later and are self-conscious about.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, if you look at what happens to boys, if for example, a boy is not ready to do the reading in kindergarten or in first grade, and he's given an extra year, we see all sorts of jumps in self-esteem. We see that the boys are then able to attack the curricula in a much more confident manner. Their achievement goes up. Their self-esteem goes up. We also know that it gives the boys a chance to physically develop so that they're able to handle themselves in their social interactions. And so overall, there are lots of positive gains. But again, we have to look at individual differences. There are some boys, as Peg said, that are precocious. I mean, they're ready to move on, and for those boys, we should allow that to happen. But we shouldn't do it just because we're told that every boy should be ready by age 5.
Let's see if we can get a phone call in before we take our break and have to say goodbye to Peg. We've got Cornelius on the line.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in my 20s, and I can vividly remember elementary school and myself and my friends getting a lot of attention from the teachers who were all female, and a lot more disciplinary problems and attention were focused on the boys in the classroom and the girls. And I'm curious if that's there's an underlying stereotype that guys are going to misbehave more than girls, or if this is going to what your guests were saying about the different ways that boys learn.
Well, that's interesting. So
that's a really interesting question. There was a school in the East Village in Manhattan that started to look at what boys and girls were being disciplined for. And the reason is because they had this barbaric practice where the boys were held out from recess for behavioral problems. So they started to look at those frequent flyers, the ones who had to sit on the bench day after day after day. And what they found is that teachers often reprimanded boys for doing things having to do with physical movement, like touching the manipulatives in math during reading period, or not sitting still during circle time, or being very physical. And the girls had infractions of a whole different level. They were much more hostile social, like that hostility and aggression in relationships, pulling each other's hair or actually having physical confrontations with each other. So it was very interesting when the school started to look at what kids got in trouble for, that there was a pronounced gender difference in what teachers nailed the kids for. And that particular school did a great job in kind of bringing that into the fore and making it a part of the discussion for teachers and really changing things.
Yeah, well, that is what always changes things, is when you bring it to the table and are able to talk about it. Cornelius, thanks so much for your call. I want to turn to you, Mark, before we go to our break. Just on this point is, I was contacted by a woman last year whose 9-year-old son developed a phobia. Mm-hmm. And he was scared to go to bed. He was having nightmares. He was scared to go to bed. And she came to me as a friend. She didn't know whether to go up there and lay with him, because he was scared, or to make him tough it out, or, would that turn him into, infantilize him? She didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a fair question, and she and I talked it through, and we had some ideas together. But after she left, I realized if it was a 9-year-old girl, I doubt it would be a problem. I don't think she would have had those questions.
Well, Dan, I appreciate what you're alluding to here, and I think it's that we have certain expectations of boys and men, masculinity scripts about being tough and self-reliant, and sometimes our expectations for boys with regard to that toughness and self-reliance might go too far. A child who's having a phobia needs reassurance and needs a gradual plan of being exposed to the frightening situation with structure and support, so in the case of a boy, so that he gradually sort of inoculates himself to the feared situation. So if we're raised with this belief that boys should just be tough and we should, knock the fear out of them, we're really not going to help them to conquer their fears.
We've got to take that break now. We'll be back and talk with Mark further about counseling boys and what boys really need. Peg, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks very much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
And I heard the laughter in your voice. I really do challenge that diagnosis of ex-girl thing. It's very, very much in you.
Nice meeting you, Peg.
All right, take care. Nice.
And thanks for your book. That was Peg Tyer. She's the author of Trouble with Boys. She's a longtime investigative reporter and staff writer for Newsweek. She serves as a CNN correspondent. I highly recommend that book. I'm also joined here in the studio, and we'll talk with him further about Mark Kiselica. He's a psychologist professor of counseling at the College of New Jersey, and he's the author of Counseling Troubled Boys. We'll be back after a short break. We'll take your phone calls at 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Jake Ray of Penn State's Smill College of Business tells us about promoting his organization on WHYY.
it's not just WHYY, it's at WHYY's marketplace, an in-depth view of what's happening in the world. You know, that type of thinking resonates well with our target market.
To learn more about how your company can benefit from underwriting on WHYY, please call 215-351-1223.
When you're fighting a serious illness, wondering what and when to tell people is probably not the first item on your to-do list. But what if you're a member of Congress?
I wanted to be Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the mom, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the fighter. I didn't want to be Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's battling breast cancer.
Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz shares her story next time on Tell Me More. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking with Dr. Mark Kiselica, psychologist, professor of counseling at the College of New Jersey. He's written Counseling Troubled Boys. But before we talk with Mark, let's listen to another clip from producer Gita Simons as she spoke with some Temple University students about their emotional experiences in middle school.
All right, let's move back in time. Let's talk about junior high. What kind of things were you guys dealing with then?
I was actually a tremendously late bloomer with girls. So that was really the most pressure I ever felt in middle school and high school. Was I always thought that I was way behind all of the other kids in terms of having relationships and stuff like that. So that was probably the most pressure I ever felt in my whole life. I really always felt out of place. I never felt like I had solid friends. It was actually really hard, because I thought that there was something wrong with me, that I didn't have a girlfriend until late in high school. I felt really disconnected, and that was really hard for me.
What did you do to deal with that social aloneness?
I developed a really strong sense of humor, and that was sort of my coping slash defense mechanism against anything.
I see you nodding over here.
Middle school was a horrible time for me and everyone else that I've heard from, just like socially and academically and in all aspects of life.
Why? What was going on?
I mean, I guess that's around the time you're going through puberty, and also there's aspects of just disconnect from school and wanting to do other things.
I'm going to come over to you with this question. Did you ever lose any friends out of your clique? Did you ever see somebody that you cared about go down a road that you never saw coming?
After middle school, I went to a private high school. That was probably one of the best decisions I made in my life, because I saw some of my friends got addicted to drugs. Some dealt drugs. Others never went to college. One of my friends is in and out of jail. And then there's like one or two who thought life would stay at 18, 17 years old. When things move on, I go back home sometimes, and the kids are doing the same things they were doing when I was 17 and 16 years old.
Well, let me weigh in with you.
I guess I think I started drinking around eighth grade, and with the friends, and you know, you see your parents' liquor cabinet and pull out the whiskey, and all of a sudden, you know, you start feeling things you never felt before. You know, certain pressures that you face, especially during middle school, like you're trying to find yourself and figure out what the next step is. And it might have been more about social acceptance for me, or just trying something new and just trying to experience the different things that life had to offer that I felt sheltered from.
And how about you? What did you use as a coping mechanism?
There were a lot of stereotypes, like you should wear clothes like this, and you should be at a certain athletic level and all that. So I tried to fit in by wearing a certain type of clothing. I get on the basketball team, you know. That was my defense mechanism. It was really, really painful. And like every night I'd go home just sitting there like, you know, what's the point? What's the point about all this? You know, I can't take it anymore.
That was our producer, Gita Simons, talking with some Temple students about their early academic years. Mark, you're writing frantically as you were listening. What strikes you about that?
Well, a couple things, Dan. The first is, if you listen to some of the comments that these particular young men shared, you can see that some of them felt a tremendous pressure to be sort of bigger than they were, stronger than they were, more socially reliant than they were at an early age. And this is a kind of a pervasive societal problem. I have a colleague named Sharon Lamb who is just finishing a fantastic book called Packaging Boyhood. And what Sharon has uncovered in her research is this tremendous pressure that we put boys under to be bigger, stronger, and older than they really are. In other words, we're often asking boys to take on things that they're not sort of emotionally and developmentally prepared to do. So one of the challenges we face is trying to figure out what are these pressures on boys and how can we create systems of support so that they don't feel as stressed with trying to live up to these expectations.
Although, I mean, there are differences. I mean, I've got a new little buddy mm-hmm. who's 8 months old. He's a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
And he just loves my wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
My grandson loved my wheelchair mm-hmm. when he was that age. I have known girl toddlers that are not interested in my wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
So there are differences. Boys' brains are different. Their bodies are different. So, you know, we will evolve differently.
Yes. Yeah, we have found that consistently if you look at the activity levels of boys, for example, and some of the preferences and the way they play, that there is that boys tend to be much more action oriented. And so that's part of the solution to trying to help boys in all sorts of settings, educational, counseling, and so forth, is to tap that action orientation in a way that helps boys to connect. And then to use that as a mechanism for forming a relationship and moving on to address difficulties that they have.
Let's go to the phones. We've got, Hal on the line.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not remembering back when I was in grade school and that recess was a big deal. We'd come back into the classroom, we'd be sweaty and exhausted, and I think our focus was heightened. It seems like research that recess is now a thing of the past, and what might have perhaps what's replaced it is the small electronic screens that kids seem to have their nose buried in. Wondering what's going on in terms of research, in terms of all the excess in electronic stimuli,
fair,
and how that might be impacting behavior.
Fair question. The research I've read, Mark, is mixed. It's, you know, as a 60-year-old psychologist, you know, all that feels bad to me, but the research is not black and white here.
Right. Well, I'm not an authority on electronic games and their influence on boys, but I do know a couple caveats that I could share in response. And was your name Al?
Hal.
Hal, I'm sorry. I do have a couple caveats I can share with Hal. The first is that he brought up the issue of recess and how important it was to him with helping his focus, and I think that he's onto something very important. And part of the reason that electronic games appeal to boys is because they're constantly active when they're using them. So it helps explain to some degree the appeal that it has. And when we want to help boys, one of the things we have to keep in mind is, given that action orientation, whether we're a teacher, a counselor, the more we can get boys outside, the more we can get them moving around, the more we can give them physical outlets for their energy, the more likely they're going to be able to then listen to us and connect with us.
Hmm. Hal, thanks so much for your call. You know, we also, you know, I cited a study, I talked about it several months ago, on ADD and ADHD, where they took kids for 20-minute walks, slow 20-minute walks in nature, two times a day, and compared that with kids they took for 20-minute walks in the city versus kids who didn't take those walks at all. The ones who took walks in nature didn't need any medication and had no ADD symptoms. I mean, it didn't cure it. The symptoms didn't stay away permanently. They returned. But they stayed away for several hours. Now, I think, you know, that just reinforces what we're talking about. It's about the environment.
Well, the environment can be a big contributor, Dan. I think you're raising a good point in terms of our understanding ADHD and its diagnosis. In our book, Counseling Troubled Boys, we have a contributor by the name of George Capalco from Monmouth University. And one of the things that George has argued is that before we go ahead and start prescribing medication to kids, we have to make sure that we do an extensive evaluation of all the things that could be contributing to a child's activity level. It may not necessarily be that a child is biologically wired to be hyper. It could be that there are things in the environment, perhaps some misguided parenting skills, that are helping a kid to be wound up.
What about misguided educational skills? I mean, how you're a clinician. I mean, you can't move the world. You get a referral of a kid via a school, and what happens when you see that the kid's behavior is a result of the educational system? How do you intervene then?
Right. Well, there are a couple ways to intervene. I mean, the first is to see to what degree are the behaviors that we're seeing a function of some sort of inadvertent reinforcement of the wrong behavior. Are there outlets for boys to have these recess breaks or these walks? As you said, that little break, that activity level, and also the reduction of certain stimuli can help a kid to regain his focus. So what we have to do is try to see, is there somebody in the school who's willing to try something different other than medication and to see will it have effect? Also, what about in the family? One of the things that George has argued in his many writings, George Capalco, about this is sometimes parents inadvertently contribute to the activity levels of their boys that that become problematic through using perhaps too much physical punishment, expecting boys to sort of stay still too long and quiet. And so if we can get all of these different players in a boy's life to agree to a plan, we can often see very positive results.
Are these issues consistent across all socioeconomic status?
Well, if you're talking about ADHD, it does cut across all socioeconomic levels. However, we do know that if you look at boys from impoverished neighborhoods, that there are all sorts of factors from those neighborhoods that make it much more difficult for boys, not only boys with ADHD, but a whole host of difficulties. Boys in poor communities are much less likely to be read to, and as Peg mentioned earlier, reading at an early age is very critical for language and reading development, right? They're much more likely to be exposed to physically toxic environments. They're less likely to have parental supervision because their parents may be out working two jobs. The school systems may not be as high a quality. And so, you know, there's sort of a formula there for boys then to drift into a whole range of problems that often have a social mechanism involved rather than something biological. So things like getting involved in gangs or cutting school or being involved sexually before boys are ready. All of these things can contribute to boys having a host of difficulties.
Hmm. Peg opened the show talking about when she noticed boys in the back of the room not saying anything. I wonder about, you know, we've talked a great deal about depression in girls. Mm-hmm. Depression in boys doesn't get talked about so much.
That's true.
And I know it looks very different in boys than it does in girls.
I'm really glad you brought that up because one of the new horizons in terms of our understanding depression in boys and men is something referred to as mass depression. And this is tied to a statistic Peg had mentioned earlier. She said that if you look at the suicide rates for boys, it's about five times that for girls. Now, why is that? A lot of it has to do with the fact that because boys are given a message that you have to be tough, that you probably should not expose your vulnerable feelings, that it's not acceptable to reach out and get help, Then what happens then is the only acceptable emotion some boys feel that they can express is anger. And so what gets called to the attention of adults is the anger and the acting out, and nobody is thinking maybe this kid is sad underneath this. And so that's something we call masked depression, that the anger and the acting out is often a surface layer for a boy who is depressed and perhaps suicidal underneath all of that.
And we've got it. We don't have a lot of time yet, but we have to touch on psychotherapy because psychotherapy is really feminine. I mean, the currency we use is the currency of emotions and finding language to describe emotions. Should therapy look different for boys?
Well, I think it should, and it's the thing I would say is that, you know, people like you and me, Dan, we went into this because we're very open, we're very verbal, we're comfortable with self-disclosure. And boys may not necessarily be that way. They, if you look at the natural way that boys form friendships, what do? They go out, they play games together, they do things in groups, and in the process of those activities, they often talk about what's going on in their world.
Right.
It may not be the sort of very emotionally sensitive manner, the sort of really feel-good moment that girls have, but clearly boys develop bonds this way, and they develop trust, and they learn a lot about each other's psyches. So what we have to do in counseling then is to try and relate to boys in the way that they naturally relate to one another.
Yeah, you never hear two guys saying, well, would you like to go out on a boat with me and sit in the lake and talk all day? But, you know.
But they end up doing that.
wouldn't you want to go fishing?
Yeah,
you know, so,
right.
Yeah, we do need the external vehicle, and psychotherapy has to look that way.
That's right. So instead of sitting down and expecting a boy to sit face-to-face with us, perfectly still, pouring out his guts, maybe we go for a walk. Maybe we shoot baskets with him. Maybe we bust each other's chops, you know, as we're doing these things, using humor and activity as a way to get a boy to talk. And you mix that up with the activity, and you get bits and pieces of a boy's story. And over time, then you know what's going on with him. You know what's ticking in his head, what he's concerned about, what he likes, what he dislikes. And he can form a friendship with you through which he can then be more vulnerable and talk about things that are on his mind.
So the dialogue begins being a byproduct.
That's right, yes.
Of activity. And that's what, you know, we heard Mikan's piece, you know, these kids that she interviewed. That's what they're asking for. They're asking for activity. They're, you know, and they want to learn through activity. Mark, I wish we had a ton of time. We could go on with this. It's such an important issue. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been great, and your book is great also.
Thanks so much, Dan. It was an honor to be here.
My guests have been Peg Tyer and Mark Kaselica. Tyer's author of The Trouble with Boys. Mark Kaselica is a professor of counseling at the College of New Jersey, and he's written Counseling Troubled Boys. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking with psychologist Paul Ekman about Deception, the show Lie to Me, the show based on his work, and his interviews with the Dalai Lama. If you've got questions, we're at voices@whyy.org, or you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Our executive producer is Mike and Scott. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern is Mr. Jonathan Glick. I'm Dan Gottlieb.
You've been listening to